This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. Today's guest is so fantastic that I have decided not to interrupt him for any commercial. So we're going to go straight to our interview and just enjoy it. And I'll come back at the end of the interview for a few moments.
Of all the authors that I looked forward to talking to when I started this program 2 years ago, the one at the very top of my list is the author that I'm going to be speaking to today, Nelson DeMille. I am so very honored to have Nelson on the program because Joy on Paper means so much to me, and Nelson DeMille's writing has meant so much to me. Hi, Nelson. Are you there?
I am here, Patsy. Thank you.
Wow. I am just, I am honored because when I started this program just over 2 years ago, one of my first guests was Doug Brunt. And Doug and I talked about who influenced him. And, of course, he mentioned you. And he said, you know, he learned so much from reading your books. And I think we talked about you for like 10 minutes. Because, I think it's true that you have influenced so many, many writers. Your writing is so absolutely terrific. And your stories are amazing. And whether they're the standalone or the, of course, your very famous series, they touch something in us. All of your writing is almost very personal. We start to feel that we know you.
Well, I don't know how to follow up with that. It's, thank you so much for all of that. Doug Brunt is a good friend. I actually saw him just recently. He has a book club that meets in Manhattan about once every other month, and I'm honored to be part of that group.
Well,
and he's a very bright young man who every once in a while I think all authors who are successful want to do some mentoring, and it's hard to pick because you don't know who's actually going to have the talent. But Doug certainly did in his last book, which was
The Trophy Son.
The Trophy Son, and the one before that is my first, Doug Brunt, which was Ghosts of Manhattan. And he's got the talent. I'm glad he's saying good things about me.
Oh, well, he did. And as I said, The Ghosts of Manhattan, which I absolutely love that book, and it had all these hints of, I could tell the minute I read it, I said, okay, this is an F. Scott Fitzgerald fan, because I saw those little hints in there. That he had this interest in F. Scott Fitzgerald. And it's very much, you know, I don't know if F. Scott Fitzgerald was a particular favorite of yours, but one of your books has been compared to The Great Gatsby.
Right, The Gold Coast, which is set here. I am in Long Island and set on the North Shore of Long Island that we modestly call the Gold Coast. And, when I wrote that, I certainly had Scott Fitzgerald in mind. And you asked about him. You know, I'm one of the few people I think really don't like his writing, except for The Great Gatsby. And I could read that, you know, every year. And it's funny with some authors, you respond to one of their books, but not others. And Fitzgerald was like that with me. But I was so taken with The Great Gatsby that I kind of copied it in my book, The Gold Coast. And yeah, anyway, I guess a very good, favorable comparison. Somebody even said, in many ways, better than Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby.
Well,
I'll take that.
Actually, I think it is better because I will admit I am very much like you. I was not. I went through a period where I studied everything that F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote, and I read it over and over because I wanted to understand his sort of methodology. But I was never a great fan. And but I am a fan of Gold Coast. Now that is a book.
And as you know, I have a new one out.
Oh, that's what we're supposed to be talking about, The Cuban Affair. And it's a wonderful book, and it has some, you can tell us a little bit about it, but I want to tell everybody that I just love the ending, fast-paced. I love fast-paced endings, and boy, do we get an ending with this book, and a nice twist along the way that I really enjoy. And that's always a feature of your books.
Yeah, you know, it was, I write action-adventure for the most part, but sometimes I do detective novels, sort of, and like The General's Daughter was a kind of a police procedural. And I don't know if you've seen the movie, but they did a good job with the movie. And I used to do espionage before the Cold War ended and put a lot of writers out of work. But I was able to shift genres. And most best-selling writers won't do that. And they won't get away from their main character because the main character is paying the rent for them. But I like to take chances. I mean, I have to be entertained. If I'm not entertained while I'm sitting here for a year and a half, then for sure the reader's not going to be entertained. So the Cuban Affair, in many ways, is a break. It's a standalone. I created a new character, and I got away from my character of John Corey. That was very successful. And the publishers and agents always get a little bit nervous when you do that. But they were very supportive in this case. And they said, you know, somebody said, you know, to me, and I'm modest to repeat it, that Nelson, you can do just about anything. You can do the Gold Coast on the one hand and the Cuban Affair on the other, which are two different books altogether, and you can do whatever you want. So I went with that, and I created a new character called Mac McCormick. And as you know, because you read the book, the opening scenes take place in Key West.
Uh-huh.
I love those opening scenes.
Oh,
you want to go back to Key West.
Now, did you do some research there? You had to do some research there at the Green Parrot Bar in Key West?
Right. That was tough research.
Oh, yeah. Were you there at the time when they were having the Hemingway look-alike contest?
No. I hate to admit it, but the last time I was in Key West was probably 12 or 13 years ago. But now that I opened my book in the Green Parrot in Key West, I am going to go back.
Oh, I'm sure.
Before the year is out.
Well, after the hurricane season.
Yeah, the hurricane season. I mentioned the hurricane season in my book. My book takes place in October 2015. And my main character, Mac McCormick, who's a charter boat fishing captain, mentions that, thank goodness, the hurricane season is just about over. And I wish you guys a lot of luck down there. I'm on Long Island. I have lived with hurricanes all my life, too. And we know how devastating they could be.
Well, I like this new character. His name is Daniel Graham McCormick. He comes from Maine. And he, as you said, he's a fishing boat captain. And I think he's a very well-developed character. And I assume we're going to see him again.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, when I wrote Plum Island years ago, it was the first John Corey book. It was meant to be a standalone because I had never done really a series of characters before. But what happens is that you get a lot of reader mail. I mean, especially now with the, you know, email through the website. You know, years ago it was typed letters or handwritten letters, but now I get like thousands of emails. And it's great because I like to listen to my readers. My readers as a group, you know, are a great market research for me. And with Plum Island and John Corey, it became obvious that I had to bring back John Corey. So when this book comes out on September 19th, I'll be looking at my email to see if anybody wants to see Daniel Graham McCormick again.
Well, I think so. I the minute I read the character, just, you know, when you start, it's sort of, well, when you feel right with a character, when a character just sort of touches something in you, and you know that you want to know more, and I think there's a lot still to be told about Mac. So I'm hoping because I, as I said, I love the way the book turned out. I love the little twist at the end, and I think it's a great book.
Thank you. I try to create the, and I know you read some of my other novels, but
oh yeah,
my characters, you know, the main male character is supposed to appeal to men and women, and I think he did. The women seem to like him for, you know, their reasons, and the men like him for other reasons. And, you know, he's a tough, macho guy without being too tough and too macho, and he's got another side to him. And all my female characters in my last 12 or 13 books have been, you know, very tough and the kind of a good challenge for the macho male character. So I think this is a good combination. These are different books, but they have the same thing. You know, I mean, we all write a little bit formula because it's you know, what people are looking for a good story, but they're looking for, people want to know about people. So, you know, once you create the characters, The plot is almost incidental. It's got to be good writing, good characters, and that's what draws people into the story. And then, of course, there is a storyline, and in this particular case, it has to do with recovering $60 million of money that was hidden in Cuba during the Cuban Revolution in 1959. So that's the what we call the MacGuffin, what everybody's after. And that's kind of what propels the book after the Key West scene.
And we won't tell people the twist because that's part of the story. And I was delighted with it. It was a nice twist. Now, you went to Cuba after you wrote the book, right?
Actually, kind of in the beginning when I started writing it, you know, it soon became clear that I needed to go to Cuba. I was ambivalent about it. I kind of always wanted to go. I think we all want to go to see what's going on over there. And I knew I was going to go. A lot of my, whenever I said a book in an unpleasant place, I wind up going. I should try studying a book in Paris once. Give me a break. But I said books in Vietnam, and I've gone. And I said books in
Yemen.
Belfast and Yemen.
Yeah, you don't want to go to Yemen. I don't know.
No, that's the only place. Jesse, you mentioned that the only place where I didn't go to research a book. I was advised not to go.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to be very welcome. I think you described Yemen. Let's put it this way. I can't say it on the radio, but you described Yemen in a way in which one would think that they would have some resentment.
Right, and the place has gotten worse since I wrote the book.
Exactly.
You definitely would want to go there now. It was possible to go when I was writing that book, which was The Panther. But now people have advised me not to go to Cuba ever again after I wrote The Cuban Affair, that I'd probably be arrested at the airport. But I would like to go back and see Cuba the way I went back to Moscow and Leningrad, which is now St. Petersburg. I went there during the Cold War. And I'd love to go, and I went back to Leningrad, which is now St. Petersburg, to see what, you know, the transition. I'd love to do the same thing with Cuba, but I don't know when I could go back. And I don't want to be paranoid because I'm a good adventure traveler, but my wife often says, you know, you're on your own. When I wanted to go to Yemen, she says, send me a postcard. She wasn't about to accompany me. I think that was my first clue that was not a good idea. But it's kind of fun to research the book. That's the fun part of the whole process.
But you did go back. You did go back to Vietnam.
And I went back to Vietnam. I was in Vietnam and all expenses paid with the United States Army in 67, 68. Then I went back in 97 for a magazine who wanted me to do a travel article. And that magazine piece turned out to be a novel called Upcountry.
Oh, I love that book. Oh, that is one of my favorite of your books.
Thank you. It was one of my favorites, too. It was interesting to go back after 30 years to see what had happened to that country. And it was kind of an emotional trip because I'd been there, you know, as a combat infantry officer in 67, 68 during the Tet Offensive. And when I went back, it was nice to see the country at peace. And the war damage pretty much repaired and rebuilt. So, you know, what I say, I don't know where my next book is set, but I don't think it's going to be, I don't think it's going to be Afghanistan.
Well, you know, I'm not even sure about Paris anymore because that's sort of becoming a rough place too.
Right.
You have to,
right.
Yeah.
Good point.
I wanted to tell all the listeners that they can go to your website, which has, there is a lovely photo of you as, when you were in the military, when you were Lieutenant Nelson DeMille, a member of D Company, 1st Air Cavalry, and it's a very nice photo of you there. That, I think, was that your first press coverage? First time you appeared in the newspaper?
Yeah, that was I think it was a UPI photo. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, the news was certainly, you know, our news media was certainly around in Vietnam, not to the extent that it is today, but I went up with a photographer with our company who's accompanying us and took my picture, and all of a sudden there was a UPI all over the country. It went up all over America, that photo. And
so did your parents see it?
Yeah, my parents saw it too, and you know, it was kind of interesting. It was kind of like the first modern war where the reporting was almost instantaneous. And from the time that picture was taken to the time it wound up as a
It's a great photo, and it is on your website, which is NelsonDeMille.net. Telling people, remember, it's .net, because sometimes they look around and they can't find things, but it is .net.
Yeah, I know.
Now, you know, the first book that I read of yours was By the Rivers of Babylon, and it was, for me, it was very exciting, because my husband is from Israel, and he was in the Israeli Air Force.
Really?
And so, of course, when we read that book, when I read it first, I said, oh my goodness. I called him, I said, Asher, there's a book here, it's about the Air Force. And so, of course, he fell in love with it too. And the book is, you know, it still holds up. It is so good. That book is just so terrific.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. The book was written in 1977, hard to believe. And, you know, the world has changed, certainly, but, you know, in this particular book, the Shah was on the throne in Iran, and Iran was an ally. Other than that, not too much has changed, and you can read the book today, you know, knowing that it was set in the 70s, and unfortunately, the situation in the Middle East is not much different than it was when I wrote the book, except, you know, to Iran for one thing, but... The book is still in print after, how many years is this? Like 40 years.
Yeah.
And still sells very well.
It should.
As do my Cold War thrillers. People just like a good story. And they're, you know, if they check the copyright date on these books, they'll see when they were written. So you have to put it in that context. But, you know, unfortunately, 40 years after I was talking about terrorism in 1977, we're still dealing with it. So, yeah, the book does hold up, which is in some ways unfortunate.
Yes, it is. Of course, in that book we have the Concorde. Had you flown the Concorde when you wrote that book?
Yes, I had. And a couple of times to Paris and London. And I was just fascinated by the plane. So.
Oh, I loved it.
It made it into the book.
Yeah, I love the Concorde. It was it was so much fun to fly the Concorde. And actually, the only time, as I said, my husband... was in the Israeli Air Force, a pilot, and really doesn't drink. And the only time he ever got really drunk was when we were taking the Concorde from London to New York. And, of course, you know, they gave you all this pre-boarding stuff.
Yeah. Wow,
and then when you get on the plane, they'll give you more champagne and this and that and this. By the time we landed in New York, he could barely walk.
Especially at that altitude. It's not a good idea to drink at that altitude.
No, but it was a wonderful plane, and so I just love to reread the book just to remember the Concorde.
And you know, my John Corey series that you mentioned earlier. It's we're working with Sony TV and ABC TV on a series, and they may make a pilot in October, and so I don't know when they're going to air it, but we're working on that now. And, we have some feature film interest in the Cuban affair, and the only one of my books that's made it to a major motion picture was The General's Daughter
with John Travolta.
Do you see that movie?
Oh, yeah, I saw it. It's good, but it's not. John Travolta wasn't my idea, but anyway.
Right.
You know, not exactly what I thought. And John Corey, I'm going to be really nervous about who they have for John Corey, because the reason that your agent or whoever came to you and said you have to write another book is that once we started reading about John Corey, I think the readers felt so close to him, with this sort of smart talking, not really crazy about authority type of guy that is in so many of us. And he just fits the bill for a hero, for, you know, not a perfect guy, not a super, you know, tough guy, not a big muscled guy, but just somebody who can, you know, just go through and find justice and... he's just a wonderful character, and I hope that whoever is involved in writing it will capture that. Because
yeah, it's always tough when you try to translate it to film, because you're limited by time, and then, you know, the casting is so important.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, John Corey's got that smart New York mouth that some people find abrasive and offensive. Yeah, but people in New York and Florida, and certainly New Jersey, you know, we kind of get the John Corey character and who he is. He talks tough sometimes and he's sarcastic, but he's a good guy. The ladies like him and the men like him. That's what you try to do when you create a character.
Well, definitely the ladies like him, that's for sure. Now, you know, talking about screenplays, I've written scripts and over the years, and I wouldn't even, you know, to do John Corey justice, I don't know who they're going to get to do the script. I hope, I understand that your son is a scriptwriter?
He is, yes. He does feature films, but he wouldn't mind getting involved with the TV series. And although he, you know, it's always difficult when you work with family. And
oh, yeah.
You know, he's a really great scriptwriter. He's got an award, and he won the Comic-Con award about 4 years ago for a short film that he did. So we're contemplating working together. We're close now, but we this would be a challenge. But I think it's worth it. I mean, he's a new generation. He's 35 years old. He's the age of my character, Mac McCormick, which is, you know, I had to start writing younger characters because some of my older characters in my past book are probably eligible for Social Security by now.
So
I created Mac as a 35-year-old, and it was kind of a challenge. I mean, you know, I'm twice that age, and now what kind of music do they listen to? How do they speak to women? You know, what is their worldview? And it was, you know, it really was a challenge, but I think I got it right. I hope I got it right. I hope the guy...
Yeah, no,
I like a 35-year-old.
Yeah, I think you got it right. I think the love story I think you got everything right there. There's a nice combination, I think.
Yeah, well, I think my characters, the other characters in the book, one of them is Jack Colby in The Cuban Affair, and he's my age. He's a Vietnam vet, and he's Mac's first mate on the fishing boat. Because I had to create that character. Then I created a character, I don't know if you enjoyed it, but I created a character of a best-selling author who was on this trip to Cuba.
Oh.
Obviously supposed to be me.
Yeah.
And, I kind of made fun of best-selling authors. I had fun with it. The editors enjoyed it, too. So I think the reading public should enjoy seeing Nelson DeMille in a walk-on part. The character's name is Richard Neville. A cognomen, as they say, of Nelson DeMille. But again, you know, if the writer's not having fun, the reader's not going to have fun.
Exactly. Well, Clive Cussler always puts himself in his books, too, so, you know.
Yeah, Clive does that.
Yeah. And speaking of writers, of course, your group, the First Tuesday Club, is fantastic, and many of them have been on my program. Larry Block is a really great friend to Joy on Paper. He's been on the program many times, and he's coming back on for the next anthology. And I love him. I absolutely adore Larry.
Yeah, Larry's got a very dry sense of humor, and we like Larry. And we have this round table that meets the first Tuesday of every month at a bar restaurant, which will go unnamed in Manhattan. And not allowed to say where it is. You know, I'm sure people told you where it is. And
yeah, they'll all everybody will come trying to snoop.
We've had people stop by, but it's interesting to get authors together, and we have about half women, half men, different publishers, different agents. We write different kinds of books, but we all have the same problem with either the writing process or the publishing process. It's a good. We exchange information. We don't talk literature. We complain about, in typical New York fashion, we complain about everything and everybody. But we are all blessed, and we know that we're blessed to have been, you know, that successful. And but it's good. It's cheaper than therapy. You know, so we all look forward to the first Tuesday of the month.
And well, I've had Justin on, and I love Justin Scott. He's one of my favorite writers. And, of course, Linda.
Linda Fastine.
Yeah.
Oh, Linda Stassi is a new member of our group. Linda has just got a new book coming out called The Judas Affair, and it's it comes out the same day my book does, actually. Linda is a columnist for the Daily News, is a columnist for the Daily News, and was a columnist for the New York Post, and she turned to novel writing, and but she's got a new book coming out the same day as mine. And we have Mary Higgins Clark there, and sometimes Carol Higgins Clark. And we have Harlan Coben and Lee Child. So it's a really, really good group. And we always enjoy ourselves. After about the third drink, our problems seem to disappear.
Well, Mary Higgins Clark has been on the program many times, and she's also talked about the First Tuesday Club. And so I've had Larry... I've had Linda Fairstein, Justin Scott. I'm trying to get a hold of Harlan, and Larry is trying to get me Lee. And so I'm doing pretty well. Now I'm going to have to get Linda Stassi. So
Linda's doing actually publicity. She should be easy to get a hold of.
Oh, okay.
And Harlan is Harlan and Lee. Lee is you know, accessible. Harlan is a busy man. I went to this other book club, Doug Brunt's book club, last night, and Harlan couldn't show because he had another commitment, but Lee was there. And Joe Cannon, you know Joe Cannon? He wrote the book about building the atomic bomb, and so we have some nonfiction writers, too. And it's interesting to talk to nonfiction writers because they come to writing from a different place. We're trying to make up stories as novelists, and the nonfiction writers are trying to tell a story that actually happened and make it engaging and novel-like. So we always learn something from each other, too, which is good. It's never, you're never too old to learn.
And sometimes you might get ideas from them.
Yeah, we don't exchange too many. We don't give away what we're working on next, but you can get ideas. The other thing about writers getting together is that, as you know, if you write, it's a lonely, lonely occupation. And if you don't have an occasion to get together, you probably would never be in the company of too many writers. I mean, we get together for the Mystery Writers Guild and the International Thriller Writers Association and a few other things. But mostly, it's a very solitary occupation. And when we do come together... sometimes I think the publishers and the agents get nervous when authors get together because we start comparing notes about percentages and royalties and that type of thing in advances. So they'd rather us never meet, but we do meet.
Now, you know, I was going to mention, because I wanted to talk also about, you are a Mensa, member of Mensa. And
right.
So, you know, somewhere along the line, you were encouraged to write. And when I talk to so many writers, I say that, you know, if you really, part of the whole process is that you have to just be persistent and you have to actually sit there and get something down on paper. Now, in your case, you write everything by hand still.
I do, yeah, I don't.
So did Doug. Doug does the same.
Yeah, he does, and Kurt Vonnegut used to, and you know, when he was alive, and there were a few of them. But still, you know, this is all we all learn how to write. Really, maybe the kids today do keyboarding and they go on the typewriter.
They text
computer.
With their thumbs. They do everything
exactly.
With their thumbs.
Right.
I can't figure out how they can do it so fast.
I don't know, but most of us of third generation learned how to write with a pencil in third grade or second grade or whatever. And I find that process just easier for me. And I do two or three drafts handwritten on my legal pads with a pencil. And then I, commit it to the computer and I can play with it there. But the first drafts need to be handwritten. And I think it makes a difference in the writing. I like to think that that my writing is better because I handwrite it and I take the time with it, and I can do crossouts right away. I put marginal notes if for myself when I'm rereading the handwritten. And you do a lot of things with a pencil and paper that you really can't do with a computer. But I love the idea that once it's in a computer, you can play with it. You don't have to retype the whole page, if you remember that. In the old days, if you had a manuscript that had too many crossouts on it, and you didn't want to send it to the publisher looking so bad with, handwritten, you had to retype the whole page on an electric typewriter, and you made new mistakes that had to be corrected again. So the technology is good from a logistics standpoint, but from a standpoint of creativity, I don't think, computers add anything to the creative process. And that's why I and others and other writers many of them are going back to the pencil, at least making notes and doing kind of a rough draft by pencil. This is what I'm hearing from a lot of people are saying. They're so over computerized, let's say, that they're going back to the basic.
Well, I don't know if Doug Brunt started off trying to emulate you with the yellow pad and the pencil, but I know that he was trying to channel you. I know he loves to do it, and exactly what he said, that we can take the pad of paper out wherever he is, and he doesn't have to worry about connections or running out of batteries or anything. There, right. You have that piece of paper, and you can get it down. Because I went to a conference where there was a writers conference where they were wanting to write. And so many of them were talking about, I have to get a computer. I have to get this this program. I have to, I said, no. Yeah, really, Tolstoy did it all by hand. If he could write War and Peace by hand, you don't need to wait until you can afford a new computer or a fancy computer program. You could just, sit there and write.
And that's, they say that Mark Twain was one of the first writers in the turn of the last century who went from, handwritten to typewriter, manual typewriter, obviously. And a lot of people say, I don't know if it's true, that his writing went downhill when he started typing his drafts rather than handwriting his drafts. There may be something to that, I don't know. But, I guess you could say whatever works. I think this new generation can only compose on a keyboard, and I get it, I understand it, and that's fine. But I'm not about to learn how to type. I can't type that fast anyway. My brain is working faster than my fingers would. But when I'm handwriting, my brain and my hand are in sync.
Well, one thing about the computer age is that we now cannot see changes that a writer might make over a period of time. Whereas in the old days, we have Hemingway's papers, we have F. Scott Fitzgerald's papers, we can see the development of their writing and how a book might have changed from the first draft to the final thing. Now, do you save all of your handwritten?
Good question. Actually, about 15, 20 years ago, Boston University approached me and I said, we understand you write by hand. We'd love to be the repository of all your handwritten manuscripts. And that's where they are now. Everything I do now goes to Boston University, and it's called the Mooga Memorial Library. Anybody who's in Boston feels like stopping at BU, the Mooga Memorial Library, and ask for the Nelson DeMille papers, they will haul out more boxes of handwritten notes and research stuff and the actual original first, second, third drafts of the manuscripts in longhand. So it's kind of neat to know that.
And
long after I'm gone, hopefully they'll still be there.
Well, it is, because think of all of the PhD theses that are going to come out of this work. Because nowadays, with somebody writes a book on a computer and they throw away everything else, so there's no research to be done, no PhD, grants to be given. But in your case, people will be able to say, okay, I need, $10,000 so I can go and study Nelson DeMille's.
I guess. Hopefully. I know people do visit the archives now and then, and they also take personal papers, and you got to be careful what you send on, personal letters. In the old days, Now we all type letters out and put them in an envelope, and I have letters that I received and drafts of, well, carbon copies of letters that I sent, and that's all there too. It's probably interesting to look at it. Sometimes you wonder if this is a good idea to do this, but I guess it's better than it being stored in my attic.
That's true, and it really, it is nice from the historical point of view as a writer, and you think, well, somebody 100 years from now really might want to come and write something about me, and I gave them plenty of research material here, so, you know.
Well, they'll probably be interested in seeing what pencil marks look like on legal pads, and saying, my God, this man, first of all, his handwriting is awful, but second of all, I can't believe he sat there and did this. The only technology I have in this office is a electric pencil sharpener.
And that's enough. That's enough. You've done miracles with that pencil, I can tell you.
Thank you.
I think sometimes when I'm reading, particularly I think the John Corey, because when John is being really, really at his sarcastic best, at his brightest, and I just imagine your pencil just going over these words, and I think it's just a miracle, really.
Well, you know, Corey sounds very bright, obviously, because the author B has time to freeze time and come back with that really good, you know, one-line zinger. We all wish we were that clever and very and quick in real life, those good comebacks that we wish we had said. But when you're writing, you have the luxury of taking a deep breath and saying, now, what would he say to this stupid remark? What kind of a sarcasm would he come back with? So, you know, the author and the character sound very clever on paper. Not always so clever in real life, I'm afraid.
When one of the books that I've been most impressed with over the years was Word of Honor. And tell us a little bit about that, because I think that it's a book that, again, people can go back to and read today. And the nice thing about your books is, well, partly you said, you know, many of your books were about the Cold War, and then we thought the Cold War was over, and then little did we know that we are now back in a very, very cold, cold war. So your books are still relevant, and of course, many of them were prescient, because you talked about things before they happened, and or, you know, your books came out, and then something happened that was very much related to the book.
Yeah, I've been lucky or prescient. But, you know, I was a political science major and history major in college, so I kind of get stuff. And, you know, with this book, The Cuban Affair, you know, I set the time in October 2015, because that's when I went to Havana and Cuba. And, you know, you know that events can overtake a book, so you really have to pick a time and say, this is when it's happening. Because since I wrote the book, Castro died, Fidel Castro died, Raul took over, Trump was elected president. So none of that's in the book, but people talk about it in the book, saying, you know about Fidel's eventual demise, although he wasn't really president at the time. So you know, my characters sound smart sometimes. Just I'm writing the book after the event, and I can look back and say, this is what a character should be thinking. Same with the my Cold War books, The Charm School for One. I wrote that book in 87, two years before the wall came down. But one of my characters in that book says about communism and Russia that this system doesn't have 10 years left in it. Well, it turns out I was wrong. It had 2 years left in it. But nobody would have believed that then. Although when I went to Moscow, I had that feeling that this is a dead system that didn't have 10 years left in it. So, yeah, sometimes it sounds prescient. Sometimes it's just luck. Sometimes you make mistakes when you try to predict the future. But that, every novelist has that problem. If you're writing contemporary fiction, the events of the world are going to overtake the book. But if it's a good story, as in, let's say, Word of Honor, which was about Vietnam, although it took place after Vietnam. That was a court-martial book. And if the truths in the book, you know, are universal truths and timeless truths, then the book will survive. All my books are still in print. And my biggest bestseller of my old books, what we call the backlist, is The Charm School, which is a Cold War thriller written 30 years ago. People still read it for the book. Just the way people read Shakespeare or they read Dostoevsky or anybody. They're reading the story and they're not looking at what's happening around them at the moment. They're saying, this is a book set in this time and frozen in that time. And if the story's good, people are going to, and the characters are good, people are going to enjoy the book.
And just like, as you said, about word of honor, I think it's as relevant today because court martials actually don't change. There's rules, and court martials are basically the same over time. And so it doesn't seem dated at all.
They did make a movie of it. It was a TV movie, TNT.
Yeah.
Before TNT was TNT, before the Mad Men. Probably about 50 people watched it in those days. This was a very small cable station. And it did a good job. Don Johnson was in it, and Gene Triplehorn. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Almost nobody has seen it. It wasn't bad, but it captured the drama of a court-martial. And the right, you could see that TV movie today and still understand the world of that book. And the military doesn't change that much. The Uniform Code of Military Justice, which I think was written probably in the 1920s or 30s, is still used today, you know, for a court-martial. And the manuals of court-martial have not changed. So, yeah, I mean, they could make that movie again today, and you could pick up the Word of Honor and read it today, and you don't feel that it's dated.
Not at all. And I think, of course, one of the reasons is that you were yourself actually involved in court martials. Not being court martialed.
Not being good, no. I haven't been charged.
No.
But as an officer, of course, you're involved with all officers in the United States Army, and I'm sure, you know, in the Navy and Air Force, are what they call officers of the court. So you do participate in court martials, either on the board, which is the jury, or as a defense counsel or a trial counsel in many cases. So, you know, you get some military law training when you're an officer. And, you know, and of course, while I was going through it and while I was doing it, I'm saying, you know, well, this is not going to help me in civilian life when I get out of the Army. But as it turned out, I became a writer. And I used everything I learned about court-martials when I wrote Word of Honor.
And it shows in the writing because it again, one of these stories that it just moves along very, very, you know, quickly. You just pace it so nicely, and it's realistic. And we really feel like we're involved there in this court-martial. And I love this book, too. I love, you know, your writing is so good. And as I said, it's going to hold up. 100 years from now, people are still going to be reading your work. And, of course, now we'll hope that something will actually come to the screen. But we know Hollywood, and it takes time. But I assume that you've made a little fortune just on the options. So, you know.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you said that. I mean, somebody told me I could have retired to Mexico just with the option money. And, you know, Hollywood buys more than they more than they use, and we understand that. And you write screenplays, and you wonder how some of the stuff gets to the screen. It never should have gotten to the screen. And how some, you know, really great novels that did get to the screen, you know, were messed up, and how some good stuff just never makes it.
Well, you know, I told Doug Brunt when I read The Ghost of Manhattan, I said to myself, this should be a movie. I want to write that movie. And if I won the lottery tomorrow, probably the book I would option would be Ghost of Manhattan. I couldn't afford to option yours because what you're getting is like astronomical. But I was thinking, you know, the Ghost of Manhattan would make a wonderful movie. And of course, as you said, I don't know some of the stuff where they get it from, because it really is so bad. And so it's that I just hope, I'm hoping that they will do justice to John Corey, because he is a beloved character.
I hope so too. But you know, these things, you know, a committee run, and the screenwriter, you know, in publishing, in book publishing, the author is at the top of the heap, and the author is, you know, why they're all there, why everybody in the publishing house is there. But in Hollywood, the screenwriter is way down at the bottom of the pyramid, and
as low as you can go. I mean,
low as you can go, right?
Yeah. Well,
they don't. They tell you they respect the written word, and they don't always respect the written word. And as we know, it's not on the page, it's not on the stage. And yet they mess around with screenplays. When they made The General's Daughter, it went through probably 13 rewrites. And I'm saying to myself, I wrote a whole novel, and I only went through 3 or 4 drafts of this novel of 200,000 words. They can't come up with a, you know, a 90-minute screenplay that makes any sense. Finally, it was William Goldman, who was a great screenwriter and a great novelist, came in, and he kind of saved the screenplay. But, I mean, to see draft after draft and then screenwriter after screenwriter, nobody getting it right, I became frustrated, and I offered to help. But they don't really want to hear.
Oh, no, they don't want to hear from authors. I mean, please. That was like, don't even talk to the author. They don't want you to get their input, because they say, oh, no, it'll ruin your mind if you get the author's input.
Right. You know, the times that you do it, like with William Goldman, Marathon Man, or Mario Puzo with The Godfather.
Then it works.
When the author writes the screenplay, you get one heck of a screenplay.
Yeah.
And a heck of a movie if they do it right.
Exactly. Well, I think you've done pretty well just writing the book, so I guess we'll have to stick with that. And collecting all the options, and I'm sure they're going to option already The Cuban Affair, which is just coming out, and a wonderful read. I've been very involved with the POWs from Hanoi Hilton.
Right. Yep.
That's one of the projects that I'm working on. It's called Forgotten F-105 Warriors, about the pilots who were at the Hanoi Hilton. So as you can imagine, I particularly love your book. And I
Thank
hope
you
that
so
everybody
much.
will get The Cuban Affair. It's a great read, and a wonderful new character that I'm sure we're going to see again in the future. And as I said, the last 25 pages or so are so exciting. Like, you can't move. You have to make sure that you don't have to go to the bathroom, because you cannot get up and stop reading that book, because the last 25 pages are absolutely terrific.
Thanks so much, Beth. I appreciate it. I really do.
Okay. Well, say hello to everyone at the First Tuesday Club.
I
said, I have a whole bunch of you already now, and I need a few more, and I'm going to get all of you. It's just too exciting for me. I really thank you so much. You know, of all the writers, there's only two writers that I want to write like, and one of them is Jane Austen. I would like to be like Jane Austen. And then you.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you so much for that.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much. We're running out of time. They need the studio. I have to go. But I want to, again, thank you so much, Nelson DeMille, for being on Joy on Paper, because you, Nelson DeMille, are a joy.
And this show is a joy. I really have fun. Thank you very much, Pat.
Oh, thank you, Nelson. And everybody, Nelson DeMille. .net is the place you can go, and you can see lovely photos of Nelson in Cuba and when he was young and when he was in the army. Okay, thanks again. Bye-bye
now. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, wow. So dreams really do come true. My goodness. I never in my life thought I would be able to talk to Nelson DeMille, and I am so thrilled that he was a guest on Joy on Paper. And this is one of the reasons why you should write a book, because you never know where it will lead. And it's always so much fun to be able to say that you have written a book. And I want to thank everybody. I want to also, you know, we just finished up here with Hurricane Irma, and I want to thank Governor Scott
and our Clearwater Mayor, George Kretikos, and all of the workers here in the Clearwater, Tampa Bay area. Unbelievable response. They were absolutely fantastic. It's amazing with all of the trees and everything that came down. The streets are almost all cleared now. They did it in really record time. And of course, we all suffered from those of us who didn't have electricity, and there were quite a few million of us. And it was a pain, but it's I have a neighbor who's 102 years old, and she survived it. I think she thought all of us were being a little silly. After all, you know, we haven't had air conditioning that many years, and so we should not get too crazy about not having air conditioning. My big problem was not having the elevator, because I had surgery because of my kickboxing on my ankle, and I had to go up and down the stairs, and it was a little bit painful, but I'm okay now, and I am so happy that our area was not devastated too badly, and we have to just say our prayers for the people in Texas who are still suffering and still trying to get out of all that muck and mess that they have. So I hope that you all make donations to the Red Cross and to anyone who helps these people. And I want to thank Big Ed in the control room. He weathered the storm here, right here in the studio. He was protecting the building, and he didn't want anything to happen. And so he just saluted me, and I'm saluting him back because he is a trooper. And we were so happy that nothing happened here, actually, in Clearwater. They didn't lose electricity or anything. It was just a little south of here where I live that we were a little bit crazy. But other than that, everything's fine. And I want to thank Nelson DeMille. And then my next guest is going to be Angela Hunt, who is an absolutely fabulous writer. And I'm looking forward to talking to her about all of her wonderful books. So thank you all for joining me. Remember to say something nice to somebody today. And just enjoy yourself, because you have to be thankful for what you have. Bye-bye now.